Today is Wednesday, November 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the European Union plans an intervention force independent of the United States.
To increase the military capabilities of the European Union is a way of increasing and reinforcing the global security.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken begins African trip in Kenya amid deepening conflicts in Ethiopia and Sudan.
And there is also very much an emphasis on democracy, as we have had military coups in several countries in Africa.
And France dismantles migrant camps as row with the UK escalates. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. European Union defense ministers have met in Brussels to discuss their, quote, strategic compass, unquote, a plan for greater shared military capability among the bloc's members. According to a draft of the plan seen by Reuters, the EU is considering a joint military force of up to 5,000 troops by 2025 to innovate in a range of crises and without relying on the United States. The EU's military strategy will be developed to complement the transatlantic alliance and the bloc's relationships with NATO, whose Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg joined ministers at talks on Tuesday, according to Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. French Defense Minister Florence Parly welcomed the plans and says decision-making processes have to be able to respond to fast-moving threats. 2 decades after EU leaders first agreed to set up a 50,000 to 60,000 strong force but failed to make it operational, the draft strategy by the bloc's foreign policy chief Borrell is the most concrete effort to create a standalone military force that does not rely on U.S. assets. EU foreign policy chief Josep Borrell.
To increase the military capabilities of the European Union is a way of increasing and reinforcing the global security, the transatlantic link, in complement of NATO. But if something is complement to other thing, it means that they are not the same thing. Complement to NATO means that the European Union not only has member states who are member of NATO, but has the ambition to build a common security and defense policy in order to use its own capacities alone when necessary and together when possible.
That's European Union Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. The White House says that U.S. President Joe Biden, quote, welcomed the opportunity to speak candidly and straightforwardly, unquote, Monday evening to his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping about issues including human rights, economic competition, and Taiwan in their first one-to-one meeting since Biden took office. She said the two sides must increase communication and cooperation to solve the many challenges they face. The talks, which was initiated by Biden, were intended to set terms for future U.S.-China competition. The United States and China, the world's biggest economies, disagree on the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic, trade and competition rules, Beijing's expanding nuclear arsenal, and its stepped-up pressure on Taiwan, among other issues. For more on the outcome of the virtual summit, I spoke with VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widaskuwara.
So I think there's a really deep understanding, both from President Joe Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping, that this relationship, the U.S.-China relationship, is a very sensitive one. It's very contentious in nature, and there are a lot of possible potential of it turning into an all-out open conflict. So they both agree to continue to keep talking, to continue dialogue on what's called this strategic stability dialogue on sensitive issues such as military capability, nuclear arms control, cybersecurity, and on the issue of Taiwan. Essentially, they are saying to each other that, look, we know that we don't agree with you on many things, but the one thing that we agree on is that we cannot afford to have an open conflict. And so we must continue to talk to each other to make sure that doesn't happen.
Talking about conflict and wars and other issues, especially on Taiwan, there seems to be a different take from the summit from the U.S. and China. Can you explain that?
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Shinoda. This is the most hot-button issue of all hot-button issues between the U.S. and China. The White House readout said that President Biden underscored that the United States remains committed to the One China policy guided by the Taiwan Relations Act. Now, what that means is essentially the U.S. is saying, yes, there is only one China. There is not two China, mainland China and Taiwan. But there is also this guiding principle, the 1979 Taiwan Relations Act, that says that the U.S. will provide arms for Taiwan to maintain a sufficient self-defense capability against a Chinese attack. Meanwhile, the Chinese is just underscoring the One China policy part without mentioning the Taiwan Relations Act and really just launching on some heavy messaging on the fact that President Biden does not support Taiwanese independence, which he doesn't, because what the U.S. wants really is to keep the status quo. There is no forced reunification, certainly not using any kind of military measures, and the U.S. just wants to keep the situation the way it is. Now, whether or not that will be compatible with China's long-term goals remains to be seen, because as we know, President Xi Jinping does not want to kick the issue of Taiwan reunification down the line, and he wants to have this reunification issue settled sooner rather than later. So that's certainly something that's kind of like perhaps in the medium to longer term. In the short term, I think both sides agree that stability is important, particularly with the upcoming 2022 midterms elections in the U.S. and also the 20th National Party Congress in China.
And there are reports that the U.S. is considering leading a boycott of the Olympic Games. What is the White House saying?
So this thing is not confirmed yet. There is some reporting about this, that the U.S. may not be sending any delegations, any diplomatic delegations to the Olympics. But that may not be the same as boycotting, right? I mean, saying that you're not going to attend a meeting doesn't mean that you're boycotting. It doesn't necessarily mean that the U.S. will ask other countries not to attend either. This desire to boycott something that's been voiced by analysts who say that democracies such as the U.S. should take a stand and not attend the Olympic Games because of what they call human rights violations by China. I mean, they're calling it the genocide games over the Chinese treatment of the Uyghur and other minorities. So it's not confirmed yet whether the United States will or will not send delegations to the Olympics. There's also a lot of COVID restrictions that will be in place. So that's another issue to consider. And the issue of Olympics itself was not discussed in the Biden and Xi summit. Initially, there was speculation that President Xi wanted to extend a personal invitation to President Joe Biden, but I guess they didn't do it potentially because of the possibility that the U.S. might reject and the Chinese side might lose face. So this issue was not discussed in the summit.
That's VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widas-Kuwara speaking with me from Washington. U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken is in Kenya at the beginning of his African trip, amid deepening conflicts in Ethiopia and Sudan. He's also scheduled to discuss growing insecurities in Nigeria and encourage deepening of democracy on the continent. Blinken will hold talks with Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta, who just returned from Ethiopia, on the country's internal war before heading to Nigeria, where he's expected to meet President Muhammadu Buhari. For more, I spoke with VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain.
There are a lot of substantial issues to discuss, including fighting COVID-19, which is very much a very big problem still in Africa and elsewhere, fighting climate change. And there's also very much an emphasis on democracy, as we have had military coups in several countries in Africa recently, including Sudan. And of course, at all the stops, but perhaps especially in Kenya, the crisis in Ethiopia is going to be a big subject because, as you know, we've had the Kenyan president going to Ethiopia. We've had the U.S. Special Envoy Jeffrey Feltman shuttling back and forth between Nairobi and Addis. And so Secretary Blinken is really going to try to boost African regional efforts to try to avert an all-out civil war and avert that thousands could possibly be killed in ethnic violence in Ethiopia.
What are the realistic expectations of Secretary Blinken's trip to Africa? A lot is riding on this trip, is it not?
Yes, it is. It is his first in-person trip to the region. He did have a virtual summit earlier because of COVID. And yes, some experts have been saying, look, we've been waiting for, you know, a new start, a launch of some specifics about U.S. policy towards the very important African continent. And we hear that we're going to be getting some of those specifics, in a speech by Secretary Blinken on Friday while he's in Nigeria. He's set to deliver a major speech on U.S. policy towards Africa. And so far, we've just been getting some little hints. But the U.S. is stressing that it wants to be a partner with African countries. And it wants to promote what they're calling African solutions to African problems, and not so much try to come in and say, you know, you should do it, handle the crisis this way or that way, but say, you know, the U.S. wants to support African solutions.
How does Secretary Blinken balance the Build Back Better other policies of the Biden administration as against the former administration, which so many African nations and leaders see as maybe anti-African in some of its policies?
Right, exactly. And, you know, I think some of these themes that we just talked about, like a focus on democracy and trying to get COVID under control and fighting climate change, these are things that the U.S. is working on at home. As you said, with the Build Back Better initiative, this is the same thing that, you know, European and other Western countries are working on. So these are really common global problems that not just Africa is facing, but I think the U.S. is trying to get back to more, the Biden administration is trying to get back to a more multilateral and cooperative approach and say the U.S. wants to work with others, alongside others, in trying to find better solutions. As Blinken has so often said, try to make democracy work for its people, so that they don't turn to, you know, autocratic solutions like we see in Russia and China. And that's the same for the U.S. as in Africa.
That's U.S. senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sane speaking with me in Washington. With the earth becoming warmer and weather events more extreme, the African Union has set up a disaster operations center in Nairobi to help monitor major hazards and provide regional early warnings for droughts, floods, extreme rainfall, food insecurity, and pests like the desert locust. Juma Majanga reports from Nairobi.
To cope with such disasters, the Africa Union is setting up a centralized monitoring and early warning system for the continent. The Nairobi Disaster Operations Center for the East African region is the continent's first situation room. The center, located at the IGAD Climate Prediction and Applications Center, uses the East Africa Hazards Watch. It's a system developed by the center for collecting and sharing multi-hazard data with the respective member countries. The center, which opened in October, is to provide climate information and early warnings to 11 East African countries. Officials say local communities must be ready to respond quickly to save lives and minimize damage. As Africa experiences more extreme weather, officials say early warnings and early action will help limit its impact. Juma Majanga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Nigerian rights activists are praising a Lagos State report into protests last year against a controversial special police unit. Days of protests against the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, or SARS, in October 2020 came to a halt when security forces fired on the demonstrators at a toll gate, leaving at least 12 people dead. The report leaked Monday blamed Nigerian security for the deaths, as Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The report described the events of October 20 last year as a massacre, stating that agents of the army and police shot at peaceful protesters as they sang the national anthem and waved the Nigerian flag during the evening rally. The report said there were 48 casualties, including 11 people killed, 4 people missing and presumed dead, and many others injured with gunshot wounds. The military, along with police authorities and the national government, have yet to comment on the report, but its findings contradict the early official position of the incident and corroborate accounts told by many protesters. NSARS activists have praised the report, including Obianoju Iloanya, one of the Abuja protest leaders whose brother was killed by the SARS police unit in 2012.
When I saw it yesterday, I think the first feeling I had was relief, because I never expected them to be so transparent or be able to say the truth. I thought that they would run away from saying the truth because of a panel that was set up by government.
In October last year, Nigerian authorities established investigative panels across 29 out of 36 states in the wake of mass protests against police brutality. They were looking into claims, many made by younger citizens, of abuse. The Lagos State panel received 255 petitions against the police. The panel's findings also showed that the military prevented medical aid from getting to the injured protesters after the shooting, further exacerbating the impact. In its submission to the Lagos State authorities on Monday, the panel recommended police reforms and sanctions for security agents who took part in the shooting. The panel also said compensation should be paid to victims and that the government must improve its engagement with the youth and publicly apologize to protesters. Last year, Amnesty International said at least 12 protesters were killed at the toll gate and made recommendations similar to those of the panel. Speaking before the report was leaked, Amnesty International spokesperson Sheung Bakare said government usually trivializes these issues.
The government has consistently refused to take our recommendations seriously. Many times they even claim that all that we are saying is absolute lie.
Iloanya says the leaked report triggered sad memories.
I felt anger and then I felt pain and frustration because these were young people that were out on the streets and demanding for better, and they were killed for that. So it's painful thinking about it.
But NSAS activists like Iloanya say the Lagos panel's findings and honesty inspire confidence and hope that it prompts other investigative panels to do the same. In the wake of last year's deadly protests, the government disbanded the SARS unit. Rights groups have said the unit was a symbol of excessive force. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
French police are dismantling an illegal migrants' campsite in a northern coastal area amid renewed tensions between France and Britain on the migrant issue. Reporter Catherine Field in Paris tells my colleague Carol Van Dam at least 13 suspected people traffickers have been arrested. She also says more than 1,000 people have been evacuated and transferred to local shelters.
The camp itself is situated very close to the French-Belgian border, right in the northeast corner of France, literally just about 35 kilometres across the water from the UK, which is where many migrants are trying to get to. Now, this particular camp had just 400 people there back in September. Since then, we now see that there's been some 1,500 men, women and children, mostly from the region of Kurdistan, who have set up a camp there. The camp itself is in the car park of a former industrial complex. Now, the police went in just before dawn. There were some 300 armed police. There was also gendarmes. There were also social welfare officials there to break up the camp. They took away all of the tents. They took away a lot of the belongings of these people who'd been camped there. These people have now been moved to various facilities in the area around that border region just across the water from Great Britain.
What is the name of this campsite and how long have these refugees or migrants been living there?
The camp is called the Grand Sainte, which is just the name of the region. There have been encampments in that area really for about the last 10 years, but they've become more in focus in the last year or so because previously, these would-be migrants had tried to get onto trains and buses and cars that were using the Channel ports to get across to Britain. But they've been growing up along this area because a lot of the migrants have been trying to come across in very small boats across the English Channel. Now, so far this year, we know that 23,000 people have made it across to England, across to the other side of this very dangerous waterway. And when we just look at the last couple of days, last Thursday, 1,185 people made it across illegally that waterway. So that was a record for a single day. So they've been coming gradually more and more to that region. And of course, we are now really heading into winter. And that was the excuse that the French government official gave just a few hours ago. So it's getting really cold. These people are not safe there. And there are not just health concerns, but there are also safety concerns for them in this area.
And this all seems to have come about now on Tuesday as a result of some talks between some diplomats between France and Britain, the interior minister of France. Does it seem like that is the case?
It's always difficult to know. The French interior minister has said that this had nothing to do with his talks with his British opposite number earlier in the week. He said that these operations take a long time to organize, and it's got nothing to do with that. Certainly, there has been a lot of pressure on the French to do something about these encampments, which are clear for anyone to see. And it's pretty obvious why these people are there. They are there just to cross the channel. There are other places in France where people come across in much smaller numbers, particularly across the mountains between Italy and France. You see a lot of them on the roads there. But this one, it's so obvious that they are there with the hope of getting across the channel, where they believe that once they're in England, that they'll be able to work, that it is much more of a possibility, particularly linguistically and for employment opportunities, to work there, you know, whether it be legally or illegally.
Where are most of these migrants from? Are they from Africa mostly?
At the moment, it's a big mix. You get a lot who have come from the region of Kurdistan and the Middle East. You get some Syrians, but you also get quite a number who come up, particularly from Eritrea. You get quite a lot from Sudan, as well as Nigeria, and pretty much those areas along the Sahel is what we've been seeing.
That's reporter Catherine Field speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Paris. Greece and U.S. tech giant Microsoft have teamed up to digitally revive one of the Asian world's most sacrosanct sites, the birthplace of the Olympic Games. The ambitious project uses technology to immerse viewers in the world of ancient Olympia. Anthi Karasava reports from Athens.
The collaboration between Microsoft and the Greek Culture Ministry will allow millions of visitors to immerse themselves in an experience that organizers say brings history to life. At a recent news conference in Olympia, the birthplace of the Olympic Games, Microsoft officials said they used artificial intelligence to map the site, augmenting reality to help restore the sacrosanct location as it might have looked some 2,000 years ago. Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis attended the launch and said the project would revive Greece's greatest commodity, its history.
Technology is opening up a completely different way of experiencing what our cultural heritage is all about. And the project in Olympia is so important because it demonstrates the power of technology, the ability to not just look at the site itself, but also the lives of people, how societies were organized.
Among the 27 monuments being featured are the original Olympic Stadium, the temples of Zeus and Hera, and the workshop of the renowned sculptor Phidias. Through data provided by Greek archaeologists, the sites are as close as possible to their original forms. In-person visitors are provided with smart glasses at the site so they can get an idea of what the location would have looked like in ancient times. Visitors also see timelines of how the sites have changed over time, as well as depictions of artifacts from various periods. Antigone Papanikolaou of Microsoft explained in a presentation.
It's like passing the flame from the old generations to the next. The fact that we can now go and experience how our predecessors were creating and living and seeing that as it was in ancient Greece, it's amazing.
Organizers say people who are not able to visit the site in southern Greece will be able to take a virtual tour using a computer or mobile app. Critics tell the Associated Press that the program will extend the invasive power of U.S. tech giants. Work on the ambitious project took 18 months, with drones and sensors being used to help map the sites. Officials in Greece, a treasure trove of antiquities, say the cultural implications for the country are now endless. Anthika Rasava for VOA News, Athens.
In other news, Russian officials are rejecting accusations that they endangered astronauts aboard the International Space Station by conducting a weapons test that created more than 1,500 pieces of space junk. U.S. officials on Monday accused Russia of destroying an old satellite with a missile in what they called a reckless and irresponsible strike. The debris could damage the space station. Russia Defense Ministry on Tuesday confirmed carrying out a test and destroying a defunct satellite, but insisted that, quote, the U.S. knows for certain that the resulting fragments did not and will not pose a threat to orbital stations, spacecraft, and space activities, unquote. It called remarks by U.S. officials, quote, hypocritical, unquote. But NATO's chief agreed that Russia's action endangered the space station. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says the agricultural sector emits 10% of the country's greenhouse gas emissions, a factor contributing to global warming. But some urban farmers in the U.S. are doing their part to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. VOA's Chris Cascaro reports.
In densely populated cities such as Washington, D.C., there's often nowhere to grow food but up. Vertical farming is just one of the urban farming concepts on display at the University of the District of Columbia's Urban Food Hub. Thomas Sweet is the university's research coordinator for agriculture and entrepreneurship.
Controlled environment ag is able to grow anywhere between 3 to 10 times as much food per square foot as a traditional farm. We're also growing in a controlled environment climatically, so we don't have nearly as much of the pest pressure, which mitigates needing to spray pesticides and herbicides as well. So there's no nutrient runoff, there's no chemical runoff from sites like this.
All the food grown here is donated to local nonprofit organizations and food banks. Distributed locally means cutting down the environmental impact of gasoline use and food waste. Leonard Githinchi is an associate professor of sustainable and urban agriculture at Virginia State University.
On average in the U.S., the food miles can add up to anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000. That is, if you add all the miles that make up your plate of food, it's just so much.
Experts say anyone can start growing food inside or outside their homes. All it takes is sunlight, a little space, and some patience. Even an apartment balcony can work. Leonard Githinchi again.
You just have to match whatever you're growing on, maybe the amount of sunlight that you're getting. So if you are getting anywhere from 6 and above, like 6, 7, 8 hours of light, then you can do tomatoes. Again, you can do peppers. If you are not getting that amount of light, you want to start thinking of the more of the leafy greens, Swiss chard, spinach, and stuff like that.
The global population is projected to exceed 9 billion by 2050. And by then, 2 out of every 3 people are expected to live in urban areas. Thomas Sweet again.
I see us more as almost revolutionaries, right? We're revolutionizing how food is grown, where it's grown, and who has access to it.
Or as these folks say, urban farming is not a fad, it's a necessity. Chris Cascaro, VOA News, Washington.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis. Join me and a panel of journalists as we discuss the top stories of the week, including President Joe Biden signed a bipartisan $1 trillion infrastructure bill that earned final passage in Congress after months of negotiations. The legislation calls for massive spending across the country to improve roads, bridges, and transportation. This and lots more on Issues in the News this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu in Washington, wishing you a pleasant day.
This is the voice of America, Washington. Ba ba ba.